I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. Join us as we meet the people and explore the places and programs celebrating the arts and culture in our communities. Keep your ears open for these sounds and the stories behind them. Our first story takes us to the Near East Side neighborhood called Englewood. The quarter-mile area near Washington, New York, and Rural Streets is one of five Indianapolis communities included in the Great Places 2020 plan. That's a project created to celebrate the city's bicentennial year by making those areas more livable, more walkable, and culturally rich. While the project is getting city support, it's the people in the neighborhood that are making sure it happens. Maria Carteña grew up in Puerto Rico. She started working for Eli Lilly as an engineer there before the company moved her to Indianapolis. 2 years ago, she left that job and opened Pia Urban Cafe.
For me, being an engineer, the creativity is not very obvious. So I am totally opposite of what I thought I was going to. What? Am I going to go and open a coffee shop? Where does that come from?
Pia is a nickname given to Maria by her family.
We bring the beans, the coffee beans from Puerto Rico. So we work directly with coffee plantation in Puerto Rico. We roast it locally, so we use a local roaster, and we bring the beans green. That definitely retains a lot of the freshness. So far has been the best way.
And while she supports her producers in Puerto Rico, it's the Englewood neighborhood in Indianapolis that drives her passion.
I personally have networked and volunteered in different areas in the neighborhood, and I also had a desire to open it up in a distressed neighborhood where it was going to be closer to organizations such like Wheeler Mission, the Women and Children Center, and Outreach Inc. and Shepherd. This is a great spot here to be centrally located among them. So because I do hire some of the women that for the centers.
I am Chelsea. I have worked here since September 25th. I came out of program at Wheeler and needed a job. I'm a single mom with four kids, and she offered me this job, and it's been great ever since. I love it. She's an amazing boss. Amazing.
We haven't have only had girls from Wheeler, but also from Outreach, which Outreach Inc. Do more work with the homeless youth. So I have had younger girls too here. Yeah, there's a different demographic in both organizations.
How big is your staff?
Right now I have three. One came from Shepherd. She's still a student, so she only comes on Saturdays. The other person lives in a neighborhood, and then Chelsea.
I've worked fast food, but never anything like this. But she's very understanding and very patient, and she works with you, and she teaches you, and she loves to help people grow, in all different kinds of ways. And I got one more sandwich like that to make.
Of all the different things that they need to work on after they come out of the program, it's sometimes they're overwhelming for them. So what we try to do here is for them that this become like a safe place to make mistakes before they go on to find a job.
This sandwich that we're making now is the portobello melt. It's got the portobello mushrooms, the grilled onions, the crushed red peppers with Italian dressing on the mushrooms. And I'm getting ready to put it on the sandwich press, put it all in here together and put it on the sandwich press, and it will be done after that.
One of the women come out of the recovery program will be nice to find a full-time job and get back on their lives and get a full-time job, get a house, get a car. But the reality is that it's hard to get back into, finding those things. So I have experienced, and whether I have here a woman here for a week or where I have one for 6 months, I see them just giving the best they can, doing the best, making sure they come on time, and definitely work on their self-confidence, and just giving them a chance. So it has been really good.
Well, I like to cook now. I didn't like to cook before. It just gives you the confidence that, you know, you can make something that people really enjoy. Every time a customer comes in, they say how much they enjoyed it and how great it was. So that boosts your confidence and all that. Yeah, yeah. So I absolutely love this job. I love it.
Maria, her husband, and 14-month-old son live in Indianapolis, but her parents, sister, aunts, and grandmother are still in Puerto Rico, where she says the cleanup continues from last year's devastating hurricanes.
We have such a beautiful island full of all these resources, and we don't make as much as, we don't grow as much as we should. There are some initiatives, so I wanted to be part of that, to continue to support them, especially the small business of a coffee plantations. And right now, due to the hurricane, we might not be able to get beans for up to 2 years. So again, it's going to be up to us that we continue to say, hey, we'll be here as soon as you are ready. Instead of like, you know what, forget about you, I'm going to move on.
And the 41-year-old is not moving on from her Englewood mission anytime soon either.
I'm not only working with a coffee shop and making sure that it's sustainable and it will be here for a long time, but I'm also working on developing other social enterprises within and within my company. So always having in mind the marginalized women and how can we help them, to train them and give them that, again, that step so they can be better suited for a long-term career goal.
Pia Urban Cafe is located at 2834 East Washington Street in Indianapolis. An enraged mother, a defiant daughter, and a worn-out woman in love with an amphibian, played by a Ball State University graduate. Now, these are a few of the films that could actually take home the Best Picture Oscar at the 2018 Academy Awards. Should we see them now or should we wait for Netflix? I don't know. It's time to chat with Matt, our film doga, Matthew Soucy. He's joining us here. He is the host of the weekly radio program Film Sociology, which can be listened to Saturday mornings at 10 a.m., Sunday mornings at 2 p.m., or Monday mornings at 10 a.m. on HD2, and also online at WFYI.org. And you have your podcast there as well, Matthew. You're a busy man.
Well, for the record, I'm also a Ball State graduate, but I am not nominated for anything.
So. And you don't have flipper feet, at least not today. So
wow,
that's a good
thing. Talk to Mrs. Soucy about that one.
All right. Well, I am not smart enough to deep dive into any of these movies, Matthew, but you are. So I'm ready to put on my life vest and wade into these waters with you. And you've selected three of the films that touched you in a certain way that if we are going to watch them before, definitely after, these are going to be the ones. The first one, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Yes, this was my top film of the year. And by the way, it's always better to watch it in a theater. I don't care how big a screen your TV is at home or your laptop or however convenient it is. There is still something about the communal experience of cinema and live theater. All right, back to the question. Yeah, Three Ebbings is Frances McDormand plays a mother whose daughter was raped and killed. It's been over a year. They haven't found the killer. She feels the police and the sheriff aren't doing enough, so she does the title of the film. She puts up billboards asking, why hasn't anything happened? The sheriff is played by Woody Harrelson, who's up for an award. Also up for an acting award is Sam Rockwell, who plays a deputy, an extremely racist deputy, who winds up going through some fascinating changes throughout the film. I use the term operatic because it is a heightened story, and in an opera, there are heightened performances. But in this film, all of the performances are really grounded and rooted. Frances McDormand is an acting force of nature. And, of course, the other two, Woody Harrelson and Sam Rockwell, and there's a good chance that Rockwell might win this year. But you also have John Hawkes, Peter Dinklage. I mean, everybody in it is really, really solid. It's not for everybody, and it kind of holds up a mirror. Martin McDonagh, who wrote and directed a great film called In Bruges, Irish filmmaker, kind of makes us look at some of small town society and really society as a whole and how we would handle certain situations.
Gritty and raw, and we have an audio clip for our listeners.
I'd do anything to catch the guy who did it, Mrs. Hayes, but when the DNA don't match no one who's ever been arrested, and when the DNA don't match any other crime nationwide, and when there wasn't a single eyewitness from the time she left your house to the time we found her, well, right now, there ain't too much more we can do.
Could pull blood from every man and boy in this town over the age of 8.
There's civil rights laws prevents that, Mrs. Hayes. And what if he was just passing through town?
Pull blood from every man in the country, then.
And what if he was just passing through the country?
If it was me, I'd start up a database. Every male baby that's born, stick him on it. And as soon as he'd done something wrong, cross-reference it, make 100% certain it was a correct match, then kill him.
Yeah, well, there's definitely civil rights laws prevents that.
Gritty, moving, as you said, not for everyone.
And also, I should also mention, there are times it's also laugh out loud funny. There are some moments in this film that are better than some of the comedies that came out in the last year.
Moving on to The Shape of Water, which a friend of mine said this is kind of like Beauty and the Beast for adults.
I said if you take Beauty and the Beast, Splash, and The Iron Giant and filter it through the wonderfully warped head of Guillermo del Toro, the guy who gave us everything from Hellboy, Pan's Labyrinth, and Crimson Peak, this is my favorite love story of the year. I love love stories where you have to say in the pitch, it just so happens. You know, it just so happens it's a mute woman and an amphibian man. It's Guillermo del Toro's kind of big, splashy Hollywood movie, but it's also R-rated because there's some off-kiltering moments of quick brutality. There's some nudity, and I know some people are uncomfortable with that for some reason, but there's also some wonderful performances. Of course, Sally Hawkins, Octavia Spencer, Richard Jenkins are all nominated. Doug Jones, who plays the amphibian man, who is a regular of the Guillermo del Toro players. Full disclosure, he's also from Indianapolis. He's also a Ball State graduate. In fact,
you talked to him.
Yes. On by the way, before Fresh Air, I had him on Film Sociology in December, right when The Shape of Water was having its national premiere. And this is Doug talking a little bit about working on the film.
It takes you out of the world you're in right now, and maybe parallels some things that are happening in our world today. But empowers you to you delve into it with a fish man at the centerpiece of the movie and what he's going through, what the young lady played by Sally Hawkins is going through.
And I'm actually going to be replaying my full interview with Doug on the Film Sociology Academy Awards weekend.
And let's go on to the last film that you're recommending, Lady Bird. And no, this is not about President Johnson's wife.
No.
This is one of those that's been talked about for a long time, kind of a out of nowhere kind of film with Greta Gerwig as a director.
Yeah,
and
this was my Saoirse number.
Saoirse Ronan, the hardest name in the industry to say, but what a performance.
Well, you keep practicing. Well, when you get this much achievement, you learn the name. But yeah, actually, Lady Bird was my number two film of the year. It's written and directed by Greta Gerwig. We don't know how autobiographical it is because it's set in her hometown of Sacramento and Saoirse Ronan, blonde like Gerwig, but it deals with a high school girl's last year of high school and what she's going to go through next, dealing with boys, dealing with mom, played brilliantly by Laurie Metcalf. It's got a mother-daughter dynamic. I'm a child of a certain age of the John Hughes films, which I think are overrated. I will take Lady Bird and even Edge of 17 over any of the John Hughes films of the day. It's more rooted and more realistic for me as far as relations between mom and daughter.
Speaking of which, we have a clip.
Why can't I just make the eggs?
Because you take too long, you make a big mess, and I have to clean the whole thing up.
Eggs aren't good for the environment anyways.
What?
You heard her.
Eat quickly, please.
Look at all these pictures. Every newspaper looks like USA Today.
Shelly and I are trying to be vegan. That's the soy milk.
You wear leather jackets.
But they're vintage, so they don't support the industry.
They aren't done. There's white stuff.
You know how much you love brambles? Pigs are smarter than him, even.
I never thought brambles was a genius, okay? Mom, the eggs are not done.
Fine, make your own thing.
I wanted to. You won't let me.
Your sister doesn't like me.
I'm hungry.
She does.
There's your chance. Going to bed.
I bet Mom has to clean up after all.
I'm going to be out here.
Some great films for us to keep our eye on. We'll certainly be keeping an eye on the Oscars on March the 4th and listening to Film Sociology.
Thank you, Jill.
Thank you, Matt. Up next, some lessons and inspiration from a dancer, a musician, and a perfect mixed media artist. And how about a cocktail? A
couple dashes of this Japanese chili and lime.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. Each week, our Curious Mix profiles a DIY or do-it-yourself artist. It's a segment we call Making It. This week, WFYI's Melissa Davis takes us to the downtown Indianapolis home of mixed media artist Lisa Barton.
This apartment is just like an ideal space for creating for me. So it's got like a lot of Art Deco touches, like the stained glass and bay windows, hardwood floors, really high ceilings. It's just, yeah, I love it. I've been here for a long time, so yeah, it's my space. Mixed media is my preferred medium because I don't like working with just one medium. Usually I like to do layered pieces, so I might start out with maybe like a watercolor background or a sketching, and then I'll go over that with like some collage, or I've been doing a lot of photo transfer lately. I like doing that kind of combination and like seeing how different media work together well to create art. Place factors into my art in like probably a few ways. One, like there are obviously like certain settings that I feel most comfortable working in. I tend to like to work at home, or if it's not at home, it needs to be a space that feels like home to me, that I can just like, you know, be wearing whatever and doing whatever. If I want to like take a dance break or something, I can do that. Or like watch some Netflix. Usually I like to have my cats around as long as they're not getting too close to the art. So, like, my environment needs to be very familiar, but then also there are certain places that I think of, like, historically. I went to Heron School of Art, so that's one place that I identify with art. Just, like, Indiana Avenue, even though that's a little more, like, music than visual art. There are different places in the city that I identify with as art and that like I kind of have a love for because of that. So I think that would probably be the best way to explain how place factors into art for me. I have so many ideas. My imagination is kind of nonstop, and that is what keeps me going with my art. Ideas, also being inspired by other artists. The more art I see, the more I want to make. The more that happens in the world, the more that happens to me, the more that I grow as a person, like the more things I want to say, like, and not just with words, but with images that come from my head, that I get from other people. It's always been a part of my life, so it'll always be a part of my life.
Lisa Barton is a contributing member of Fossafoss Collective.
Centered around pro-blackness, womanism, feminism, all the good things in life that I really care about.
That's Making It, reported and produced by Melissa Davis. Each February, the Arts Council of Indianapolis celebrates Black History Month with a series of free performances of dance, music, and theater. They do so during the noon hour at the Arts Garden in the downtown Circle Center Mall. This year's theme was Art and Soul, and it included two veteran Indianapolis performers who were making their very first appearance in the event. Classical violinist Jesse Hawkins with the Carmel Symphony Orchestra and dancer Lauren Curry, who also serves as development director for the Indianapolis Movement Arts Collective.
I started with ballet. It was pretty clear that I did not have a classical ballet body, but I love the order and the system of ballet. And then I went to college and was exposed to a greater degree to modern dance, and realized that there were there was all sorts of wiggle room within the system that I had been introduced to. And that's what's beautiful about modern and contemporary, is filling in the crevices that sometimes ballet can leave unexplored.
As an African-American woman, did you find it harder or easier to move from ballet into modern dance? Is there a more acceptance in the modern dance world as opposed to ballet?
Definitely. You know, dance is an aesthetic art form. And what those people were honing in on was the look of a certain body that many Black women are not born with. But I think just in the way that, you know, Picasso turned things in the art world on their heads, I think that Black dance artists can do the same for ballet or wherever they choose to migrate to. The work that I'll be presenting on the 8th has a lot to do with the construction of identity, which is difficult for anybody. But when you add Blackness into that equation, it makes it even just that more complicated. And so art is communication. And if I feel like I am saying something that someone needs to hear, and if I think it will come across and that someone will feel less alone for having heard it, then that's when I know I'm on the right track.
Jesse, what was it that drew you to classical music?
One of the ministers of my church when I was a little kid was an amazing pianist and a singer at the same time. So he could sing and preach and play from the piano. He'd do all these incredible things. And the audience was really affected emotionally by what he was doing. So I saw that kind of transfer. I didn't put it together until I became serious about being a classical musician. When I focused on the violin, suddenly the ability to communicate through music, through instrumental music, was illumined for me in all of its aspects. When I was a kid, I thought James Brown was the king of music. And all the other R&B artists that were so wonderful in the 50s and 60s, you know, through there. And I grew up with that stuff. I heard Antonio Vivaldi's set of 12 violin concertos, Opus 3, and I could draw a direct musical parallel between Vivaldi and James Brown.
And you're going to be able to showcase and do that outreach directly as part of the Art and Soul program, too. How are you going to do that?
When I was a violinist for the Fort Wayne Philharmonic, one of the local restaurateurs would come to our concerts and heard me play. And he it occurred to him that, you know, he could have me come and stroll in his restaurant on Valentine's Day. So I figured I'd do that because it's a way that I can actually move around the audience if I want to, and I can kind of schmooze a little bit, you know, talk about the violin. Hey, you want that a little softer? I can do that for you if you like, you know. Do you remember this song? I bet your grandma knows the words to this.
You're a walking edutainer.
That's exactly it. You kind of have to be, you know, because with the classical arts, I think the classical arts have a responsibility to break through that barrier of stuffiness, of over-high intellectualism, you know. Sometimes for me, classical music is just a little too sterile. And then I pull out my Romanian folk songs with George Samfir and his band of four scurrilous violin players, a cimbalom player, and a bass player who sounds like his bow is strung with rope. And it's just the most, you know, really grassroots music making. And if you need to bring that to classical.
You play a little bit of something here for us so we can get a little something on tape, please.
Okay, I'll try to do this without having warmed up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Keep listening. We'll be back with more Curious Mix. Have you ever viewed a painting or a photograph that transported you to a different time and place, but you weren't sure where or why? Curious Mix contributor Mark Allen has found not one, but two eye-catching works of art at Newfields.
There's an episode of Seinfeld where Jerry is dating an artist, and George confides in him. "I don't get art," he says. "It always has to be explained to me, and then I have to have someone explain the explanation." A lot of people feel that way. Me, I get art. I know what I like. I just don't know enough about art to be conversant. But I like to look at art. And not long ago, I was walking through Newfields, and I saw two paintings that I can't get out of my mind. One is an intricately detailed landscape called Beech Trees by William McKendry Snyder, and the other is a vivid streetscape called Washington Street, Indianapolis at Dusk by Theodore Grohl. I wanted to know more about both of them. They're both in the museum's permanent collection. So I turned to Anna Stein, a curatorial assistant at Newfields.
Right now we're in what we sort of call the Hoosier Gallery or the Indiana Artist Gallery, where we feature a lot of work by Indiana artists, especially from like the 1880s through around 1900, okay. Which was when we had like the Hoosier Group and the Richmond Group sort of pop up on the Indiana landscape scene. With the beech trees, Snyder was an obsessive painter of beech trees. He started out with portraits, which a lot of artists did. Bread and butter, people will pay you if you paint their picture. But he really loved landscapes. He was originally from southern Indiana and loved painting beech trees in southern Indiana, and he really sort of became an expert at that. So this is a very sort of typical scene from him, where he would go out with a photographer friend. He would do studies to get a sense of what the light was like that day, a sense of the atmosphere and the color, and then his friend would take photographs. And then he would go back home, take his friend's photographs, take his color and light studies, and put together a finished piece with this really obsessive amount of detail.
Okay, but this is a painting, right?
Yes, yeah. But it was, he would use the photographs as, he'd put the photographs up and the studies up, and he'd look at those as he was putting together his final painting. And that's where he gets this incredible amount of detail, is he was able to transfer it from the photographs onto his canvas.
Yeah, I mean, I look at that and I think, this looks like a photograph. And
right.
It's just, it's extraordinary in its detail. So, I mean, is there something a painter does to get this level of detail other than being obsessive and studying it? I mean, what happens in the process to make something like this?
For the process for him, it really would have been just sort of the patience of taking the time to use a small brush and carefully. If you look closely, you'll see he's daubed on almost every single leaf. Mm-hmm. And if you look around the gallery at the rest of the paintings, most of the other artists at the time were working in a style where you were often doing your painting outside or you were working in sort of a brushier manner, more of an impressionist-inspired approach. And Snyder intentionally chose not to do that. He would take his studies home, work in his studio, and just basically meticulously take the time to do small work, small brush, and a lot of patience.
So what does it say anything about me as a person who walked in and saw this that I particularly am drawn to this?
Oh, I don't want to, take apart your psyche too much. But I think it shows an appreciation of hard work and attention to detail.
Yeah, okay. All right, let's say that.
I love this Snyder. It's sort of an odd bird for this gallery. He was intentionally not doing what other artists were moving towards at the time, but I think he knew what he liked, he knew what he was good at, and he was very successful in southern Indiana and over into the Cincinnati area.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, good. Let's go look at the other painting. Okay, so this is...
Right, this is Washington Street, Indianapolis at Dusk by Theodore Grohl. And he was a German artist who was in Indianapolis in the 1890s. He had come to Chicago for the World's Fair. He was a judge for the German artists, and that was 1892, 1893, and then he had family in Indianapolis and stayed around the Chicago-Indianapolis area until 1895, and then went back home to Dusseldorf and exhibited this painting in Dusseldorf.
Okay. And I look at this and I think, well, how did he do this? Because it seems to go on forever. It has that, I mean, obviously it's two-dimensional, but it has this feeling of going on. I mean, you really feel like you're looking down Washington Street. And so I'm wondering how.
So Grohl was best known for doing sort of cityscapes, architecture scenes. He would travel Europe, paint the cities he saw, and then those would be fairly successful back home in Germany. And so he would have applied, you know, perspective. He gives you the big wide street that you can sort of look down, right? And that helps create the sense of depth in the painting. And he uses atmospheric perspective. You see things start to get hazy. The light, the gas lights in the street get kind of hazy as you look back. And it creates this really beautiful sense of sort of foggy perspective, you know, at dusk in the city as you sort of look down the street. And so he would have been... had plenty of experience doing similar things in other cityscapes, and he just sort of applied that to Indianapolis, which to the Germans looking at it back home would have been another, you know, faraway city that they were admiring.
Yeah. I mean, again, it kind of has a photographic feel, although the people are very much painted. I mean, you look at that that way.
But, it's a lovely painterly quality to
that. Yes, yeah. It's kind of amazing. And interesting to think of what our city looked like at one point.
Yes, you know, it's very popular with our docents and a lot of our guests because people love to look at it and say, oh, I recognize this building, but clearly all of these are now gone, you know, and sort of positioning yourself in our downtown today.
Hotel Tango Artisan Distillery is just a few minutes east of downtown Indianapolis in the Fletcher Place neighborhood. The distillery sources local grains to make a variety of spirits, including the spicy, smooth Romeo rum. It's just one of a number of aromatic ingredients in a drink appropriately named Curious Mix.
My name is Andrew Brown. I'm a bartender here at Hotel Tango, and today we're going to make a really delicious cocktail. I'm going to start off with taking a couple wedges of fresh-cut grapefruit and two fresh-cut lime wedges as well. Boom. You take the muddler, get that muddled down, get all the fresh juices here from the fruit in the bottom of the shaker tin here. 2 ounces of our Romeo rum. Made here at Hotel Tango. Along with our rosemary simple syrup that we also make here in-house. Here at Hotel Tango, we like to make all of our own infused alcohols, all of our simple syrups, starting to do a lot of our own bitters and liqueurs and stuff like that as well. So everything real fresh here. Then we're gonna do a couple dashes of this Japanese chili and lime. Bitters. Some ice. And my favorite part about this drink is you just get to dump the whole thing right in the glass. Besides the way it tastes, obviously. Take a little piece of rosemary, and we'll kind of hit this little piece of rosemary here with the torch, get it nice and smoky, kind of bring out the aromatics on that garnish, drop it in there, and served. That's one curious mixed cocktail.
Hotel Tango products are available at their tasting room and at a number of restaurants and retail outlets around the state. The owners have also purchased farmland on the city's southeast side where they plan to grow their own grains, herbs, and florals for their products. Still to come, a poet, a printing press, and appreciating a classic. Keep listening as Curious Mix continues. Curious Mix is a blend of stories from around the city and the state that celebrate the arts and culture of our communities. We've also lined up a regular cast of contributors who we think have stories worth telling each week. And that includes Kyle Long. He's host of WFYI's Cultural Manifesto. Let's listen in as he asks a local musician to share his 5 favorite songs.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm here with Marty Green of Bye Bye. They have an amazing new album out titled Metamorphosize. You can listen to that album or purchase a copy online at byebyemusic.com. That's byemusic.com. Marty, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Kyle.
Anything you want to say about Bye Bye before we jump into your five songs?
Like what? What would you like to hear about Bye Bye?
What would you say to the folks out there listening who haven't had a chance to see you guys live? What would you tell them about the sound of the band?
People seem to want to dance while we play, and that's really nice. I really like that.
And these five songs you're going to share with us today, they're these five favorite songs. How would you
categorize? We're going to call these the five favorite songs. I had to come up really quick when you asked me to come up with five songs.
And, yeah, that's how we do it.
And your question? How do I describe them?
You just did, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
What categorize them, I said. But yeah, what's your first pick for us?
Okay, Marty? Well, I got them all mixed up here, and I really don't have favorites. But over the last probably 5 years, I went into the library and I got all kinds of CDs to try to, you know, just to get back into music. And the one that just kept popping up and I kept listening to over and over again was Yusuf Lateef's Eastern Sounds. And I think it's a beautiful record. And it's like I'm a melody lover, and everything he does is melody. And the song off of that, I would say, you know, I'm mixed between both of them are soundtracks to old movies from the 60s. And The Robe is beautiful and melancholy, and then there's this an amazing Spartacus version of Spartacus. Do you know that one?
It's one of my favorite tracks.
Isn't
it's
it incredible?
On the oboe on that one. Yeah.
Is it oboe?
It's
so simple that it just like it charms you like the snake right out of the basket, man. Do I move on?
Yeah, what do you have next for us? Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I'll just go straight to the Sly Stone. Like, I was like, I heard it the other day under the radio, and there's just something about it that just continually blows me away, and it's the song Hot Fun in the Summertime.
End of the spring, and here she comes.
I don't know where the bridges begin and where the chorus is, whatever. It's just something about that. I mean, I like all the Stone, but something about that one seems like the immaculate, perfect pop song. And one that, one album. I just go to albums, but the song I can't overstress is, and, you know, I've seen him a couple times when he's come through, and Lee Perry's he's like turned into an old joke, really. But the whole album, Super 8, blows me away. But Dread Lion still, I think, is like, I don't know if you can get deeper than a dub reggae cut than that.
Fourth song, I think we're up to.
Yeah, we're up to fourth. Okay, yeah. I wrote a couple down. I got All the Young Dudes from Motha Hoople. Went through a phase of Motha Hoople where I really loved that band. I think I really wanted to love an obscure glam band, and that's about the best I could get. But there was something about them that was like, you know, I think they knew that they just were never going to really quite pull it all the way together. And that album they kind of took with a sense of humor. And their version of that Bowie song is just, it kind of sounds, it's really cool how it sounds like the song of a generation.
Television man is crazy, Sam with juvenile delinquent Rex. Oh man, I need TV when I got T-Rex.
final song, your final track for us?
My final track, you know, and these are all quickly pulled out. I'm going to regret them all, but I kind of want to go to Halo Gallo from Noi, you know. And when once I head over to Germany, it's like they all fight for, you know. I want to talk about Harmonia. I want to talk about all of them. Which Halo Gallo is a little connected to Harmonia too, but Halo Gallo, you know, that's the simplicity of that. I'm still trying to find a way to mix that with something else and combine it. But you know, it leads me to it always reminds me the beauty of minimalism and how minimalism seems to never get old.
And Marty, your new record with Bye Bye is Metamorphosize. Folks can check it out online at byebyemusic.com. Thank you for sharing these five incredible classic tracks with us. I love all these bands. So, yeah, I endorse your picks.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Each week, Kyle explores the history, harmony, and humanity of Indiana music on Cultural Manifesto. You can listen to it online or on 90.1, Wednesday nights at 8 and Saturday nights at 10. Terry Border is a visual artist whose end product is a photograph.
And I start with normal objects that we might have around our house, in the pantry, the kitchen, medicine cabinet, and I kind of bring those to life, anthropomorphize them.
Yep, you just heard that correctly. He said anthropomorphize, which means he finds inanimate objects like a wine cork or a piece of bread and then gives them human characteristics.
And have them tell a story, usually with some humor.
Actually, always with humor, because Terry writes books for kids.
Yeah, I have, five full-length children's books that I've written and created. And I think we have four board books, which are the smaller ones that, you know, three- and four-year-olds will play with and read.
And then there's his scratch and sniff book,
which I think is just so weird. I love it. Just strange. But I love those things when I was a kid.
What is the muse that lights Terry's artistic fuse? Poetry.
Someone gave us a book several years ago. It was a collection of all kinds of poetry, from really old, you know, Shakespeare to really accessible and funny Billy Collins poems. And I just started reading them, and I didn't know I liked poetry before that. And I found out that I don't like all poems, but there are a lot of them that I do. It's kind of like music, you know. Maybe you don't like a certain genre of music, but there is some kind of music you do like. A lot of people think, oh, I don't like poetry. There are so many different kinds of poems out there. And I think people maybe just don't give the whole genre a chance.
Terry can find his fix in a number of places, too.
I go through books, or I also go online. And there are several really good poetry websites. And the funny thing is I'll search for a title or a subject matter, maybe like cheese or beer or coffee, and just to see what's out there. There's always some kind of interesting poem to go with that subject.
And from those words come Terry's books.
There are a lot of funny poems. There are a lot of clever wordplay poems that I really enjoy. In my work, in my children's books, the kids love puns. So I do a lot of puns and wordplay. And these poems really kind of inspire me in that way.
We just couldn't say no to a guy who uses big words and creates books that stimulate all of our senses. So we have asked him to share some of his favorite poems with us on a regular basis.
Okay, this one is called You Can't Take It With You by Josephine Jacobson. Two little girls who live next door to this house are up on their trampoline. The window is closed, so they are soundless. The sun slants is going away, but now it hits full on the trampoline, and the small figure on each end. Alternately, they fly up to the sun, fly, and rebound. Fly, are shot up, fly, are shot up, up. One comes down in the lotus position. The other, outdone, somersaults in air. Their hair flies, too. Nothing, nothing, nothing can keep them down. The air sucks them up by the hair of their heads. I know all about what is happening in this city at just this moment. Every last grain of dark I conceive. But what I see now is the two little girls flung up, the sun snatching them, their mouths rounded in gasps. They are there. They fly up.
After reading this one, did it inspire you in some way?
You know what this one really touched me is these days with the crazy news and goings on every day, I look for distractions. I look for happy stories. I look for things to be joyful about, because what I do is I try to make joyful art in general. That's what I do. So this is what this poem was about for me, just finding the little joys to focus on.
That's Terry Border, and he'll be back with more Poetry Joy next week. If you think you've got a lot of pressure at work, wait till you hear the story of how an Indiana woman keeps the oldest continuously operating letterpress in America in business. Curious Mix contributor Joy Hernandez brings us the story.
In an age where making a print or a poster can be as easy as clicking a mouse or typing Control plus P, Kim Miller's Tribune Show Print is holding its own, living the idea of old school cool.
This business is 140 years old, so it has kept going through the test of time, even when letterpress was a dying art. And it's coming back now, but the people love it because of how flashy it is. You can see like the digital prints and they're beautiful in their own right, but you get one of these posters and they're so big and the colors are so vibrant because it is all oil-based inks, and they really stand up to weather.
Now based in Muncie, out of the Mad Jacks building, Miller walked through a demonstration print.
First, we're going to grab a chase. It is an empty metal frame that we set everything in.
While always located in Indiana, the company stayed in the Benton County area before its move to Muncie.
It was up in that northern part, so we were really into the blues for a long time because we were near Chicago. So they would, you know, go up there. People would drive down because it wasn't that far, order their posters, come back, pick them up, put them up for their gig. And Mississippi, we're pretty well known because of the blues as well. We do wrestling events. Obviously, carnivals are a big thing.
To make each poster, Miller hand sets her letters, measuring to fit her 14 by 22 inch layout.
I have this piece of wood. It doesn't look very important, but this tells me how tall my poster is. So I know everything I'm setting. I know where I have to start and where I have to end to fit everything into my poster. All of this wood spaces everything because I don't have, you know, a space bar and an inter bar to move everything around. So I grab one of these. Everything, when you're looking, when I'm grabbing the letters, you're going to notice is upside down. The reason printers set everything upside down is because when you're checking it, you're still reading the correct direction that you're used to when you're reading in a book. So while it's upside down, you don't have to try to flip everything in your mind. You know you're still reading the correct direction.
Tribune Show Print is home to nearly two dozen printing presses, with the main press built in the 1890s. There are several typesets in a variety of fonts, including one set carved in the 1860s. Miller also uses metal type for smaller work and various clip art style carved images to jazz up the posters.
It's kind of like a puzzle in here that we put together.
Miller stacks the type and the wood spacers into the chase and uses a special key to apply pressure, making sure all of the pieces fit snugly and won't fall out.
When letterpress was, commercial for everything, you know, your business cards, your building information, your sheets that you might fill out just in like a science lab. Everything was made by letterpress, and obviously including newspapers. It was a very men's dominated world at that time. Things were heavy and things were just a lot different in those times, where now letterpress is making a pretty big comeback. And it's a lot of women who are bringing it back. So, like, I'm running this shop. I never would have been running this shop, you know, before. And women are bringing it back in a different way. Some are, it's more of an art form now than let's make a newspaper, let's make these business cards.
Miller loads the rollers and applies ink to the printer, and then runs a few passes to get everything evenly coated. A small electric engine turns the wheels and the gears, sliding would-be posters back and forth around the drum and over the letter-filled chase.
Everything is hand-fed, so each sheet that goes through the press, I actually have to put in individually.
The poster's background colors are pre-printed at the shop in batches. Judging by the examples decorating the shop, the most common color combination is bright bands of magenta, yellow, and cyan with black ink. Other varieties include red, yellow, and green, or solid posters in a darker blue or silver.
It's a lot of fun, and our main goal at the end of the day is just to make people aware of it and know what Indiana has. We're a hidden gem, and we just love to have people through and educate them about it.
For Curious Mix, I'm Joy Hernandez.
Our music was composed by Brandon Meeks, and this Curious Mix was created by
Melissa Davis,
Sarah Neil Estes,
Matthew Sosi,
Lauren Chapman,
Matt Pelser,
Roxana Caldwell,
Abby Terzini,
Mark Allen,
Joy Hernandez,
Terry Border,
Kyle Long,
and me, Jill Dittmeyer. We'll be back again next week with more Curious Mix.